Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rowan Miller. I'm a program manager on the Entity Framework team at Microsoft. Entity Framework is going to be the topic of our discussion today. We're going to be looking at what's available at the moment and what's coming up in the future. Just so I make sure we have a talk that is useful to people, I want to get with a show of hands. How many folks in the room have used Entity Framework or have sat in an EF session before and have a good idea of what EF's all about? Great. Almost everybody. That's good because this is a level 400 session, so it's going to be pretty technical. I'm going to kind of assume that you have some prior knowledge of data access in general and hopefully EF as well. If that's not you, don't stress out. You should probably understand most of the session, but if you're looking for an introduction to Entity Framework, you're not going to get that in this session. But I've got a link there to a Bitly bundle, and a Bitly bundle is just a whole set of links packaged together on a page for you. And one of the links there will be a link to my session last year at TechEd, which was an introduction to Entity Framework 6. So just to set the expectations, we're going to go pretty technical and we're going to go pretty quickly through content. Okay, so we're going to start with a couple of slides. I'll go through them quickly. We're going to talk about EF6, which has been around for a while now, 6.1, which was our most recent release, and then the patch 6.1.1 release, coming out very soon. Most of our time will be spent in demos. We'll start with EF6 demos, looking at a real-world application or real-world-ish application, and implementing some functionality using the more advanced features in Entity Framework 6. Then we're going to turn our attention to the future and look at what's coming in EF7. And then my favorite part of the talk, which I'm going to try not to rush to, is to look at a sneak peek of some of the stuff coming in EF7. So let's start with where we're at the moment with Entity Framework. Hopefully most of you have seen this slide, or at least the start of it before. So the original versions of EF were baked into the .NET framework, and the tooling was in Visual Studio. This was great because it meant you always got EF on your machine, but not so great because it meant it took us 2 years or so to ship new features. So then we went to this hybrid model with the next few releases, where the core components of Entity Framework stayed in the .NET framework, but the new stuff we worked on, we shipped out of band on NuGet. We used this model for things like the DB context API and code first, and it helped us ship those quickly. The downside of this is that some features required changes to the core components, and so those still had to wait for the next rev of the .NET framework. In EF6, we bit the bullet, and we moved completely out of band, shipping on NuGet. So the entire EF stack was shipping out of band, and we could implement features quickly and ship them. The tooling, we also went out of band, so we didn't have to wait for Visual Studio releases. We could ship them on the download center. But then, of course, when you install Visual Studio, you always want the latest and greatest. So whenever VS releases, we include the latest version of Entity Framework in the box. So in VS 2013, you got Entity Framework 6 in the box. And in VS 2013 Update 2, which just released, you get Entity Framework 6.1 in the box. Entity Framework 7, which we're going to talk about at the end, also follows this same model. So here's a giant wall of text we're not going to talk through. But my point on this slide is that EF6 includes a lot of cool stuff. The contents of my talk at TechEd last year was basically digging into all these features and demoing about half the ones listed here. So if you want an in-depth look at what's new in the EF6.0.0 release, go to the Bitly bundle. I'll put the link back up at the end and watch last year's session. For those of you that didn't know, EF is also open source, and we take community contributions with a high bar for quality, etc. But in EF6, we took 23 contributions from the community. I've called out some of the bigger features there. Most of the other contributions were bug fixes or other small improvements to functionality. 6.1 has been out for a little while now. We really wanted to clean up our backlog a bit, so we took all the high-priority bugs we had, things that weren't super critical but we wanted to fix, and we got them all fixed, so there's 120-plus bug fixes in there. We also had this kind of strange situation where we had the Entity Framework tooling, which worked with the EF Designer, but if you were using code first, you had to go and download some separate tooling from VS Gallery, the EF Power Tools. So in 6.1, we took the main functionality from the Power Tools, which was the ability to create a code first model from an existing database, and we rolled that into the main wizard in the Entity Framework tooling. This also added the capabilities to do things like selecting which tables you want to import, switching on and off pluralization and all that other stuff you got when you were reverse engineering a model with the EF Designer. And there's a few other features there as well. In the Bitly bundle, I'll include links to get demos of those other new features. The community contributions kept coming. 6.1 was a much shorter release time than 6.0.0, but we still got 17 contributions in. Again, I've called out some of the bigger ones there. The others were bug fixes, small bits of functionality, etc. We're now working on the patch release, 6.1.1. There'll be a beta of this coming out very soon, possibly next week. We're not committing to particular dates, but as soon as it's ready, we'll publish a beta. And then, depending on the feedback we get, we're planning probably to go straight to RTM from beta on the patch. But if we get more bug reports, we might do an extra beta or a release candidate as well. For our team, the patch is just about fixing bugs. In particular, very high priority bugs. Some of these are regressions that we introduced in 6.1, so stuff that we broke that used to work, and then just some other high priority bugs that have come in. We're also taking contributions still. So far we have 12 contributions into the patch release, most of them bug fixes and small tweaks, but I called out one particular feature there. Okay, that's enough of slides, right? So let's dig into some code in VS. So the application we're going to be working with today is Fake Estate, which is my imaginary real estate company. The slogan for it is unreal real estate for real people. And this is their internal application. So it's an internet application that they use for managing the inventory that they have, the properties for sale. So on the home page for this application, they get the latest two listings that have been added to the database. If we go to the listings page, all of the listings are displayed here, and we have the ability to insert, update, and delete listings. So very standard MVC functionality. So it will be no surprise to you if I swap to Visual Studio that we see an MVC application here. We see a listings controller, which we're going to be spending a bit of time in. And in the models folder, we see a listings model, all kind of centers around this POCO class, which is a listing. And we have a fake estate context, which is an entity framework context, derives from DB context, has DB sets on it, and it's a code first model. So we see a little bit of configuration there too. So the one problem that Fake Estate is having with their application is that they keep mistakenly deleting things from the database. So if I were to go to one of these properties and say delete, if I were to confirm this delete, it would wipe the data from the database. Now for these guys, this isn't ideal because at that point, it's a very expensive operation if that delete was accidental. You can also imagine in other scenarios like financial applications that actually physically deleting data from the database is not an acceptable thing to do. So for our first demo, we're going to be looking at implementing something called soft deletes with Entity Framework. This is something that Entity Framework doesn't implement yet. So we're going to look at using some building blocks in EF to implement this ourselves. Soft deletes is just a matter of setting a flag on each row in the database to say, treat this row as if it's deleted. So we're going to use command tree interceptors, which came in EF6. We're going to use custom code first conventions from EF6. We're going to use the ability to annotate the entity framework model, which came in 6.1. And we're going to use the ability to create update command trees, which came in or is coming in 6.1.1. Now this demo is a little bit involved. So before we dig into code, I just want to walk you through the architecture of what we're going to build. So we're using code first. So Entity Framework uses a model builder to create the EF model. This is something that EF keeps in memory that represents the shape of your CLR types, represented in blue on the slide, the shape of your database represented in orange, and how those two things map together. In our case at the moment, it's a very simple one-to-one mapping. We're going to introduce a new attribute that says there's a particular column I want to use to flag soft deletes. The easiest way to get a column into the database is include a property in our class, so we'll do that as well. We'll then introduce a custom convention which will read in the attributes from our class and turn it into a model annotation. So this annotation is just a little bit of extra metadata that we stuff in the model that we can then use throughout the stack. In our case, we're going to use that annotation when we interact with the database. So for example, when we send a query, that goes through the query pipeline and gets translated into SQL that is sent to the database. we're going to introduce a command tree interceptor that is going to intercept the query when it's still an object model before it gets sent to the provider to translate into SQL, and we're going to specify some additional filters on there. And then finally, when people try to delete data using Entity Framework, normally that goes through the update pipeline. We create an object model that represents the delete command that gets sent to the provider to be translated to SQL. Again, we're going to use the command tree interceptor to intercept that object model before it goes to the provider and replace it with an update instead. All right, let's dig under the covers and start implementing some of this stuff. So the first thing we're going to work on is the attributes to model annotations. So we'll close down and go back to Visual Studio. For the demos, I've got some stuff already stubbed out, basically just classes and using statements, because you don't want to watch me type that stuff. And then the code we're going to need to write is somewhat involved in places, so I'm going to use quite a few code snippets. The reason I do that, I want to kind of walk you through the process of what it would be to write the code, but I also don't want to take 2 hours while you watch me type out code. So we already have a soft delete attribute implemented. You can see it just records a single property, which is the name of the column we're going to use to flag soft deletes. So let's go to our listing class. And we'll introduce soft delete. We'll call the column isDeleted. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to introduce a property called isDeleted. Okay, so now that we have the attribute on our class, we need a way to read that attribute and stick it into the Entity Framework model. So to do that, we're going to write a custom code first convention. So I can do that in the onModelCreating method. And so I'm going to use a code snippet here for a soft delete convention. Now, I could write this convention from scratch, but fortunately in Entity Framework, we include a base class to help you out here. So this is an attribute to table annotation convention. I say that I'm interested in the soft delete attribute, and the annotation that I want to stick in the model is going to be a string, because all I want to record is the name of the column to use. I then specify the name of the annotation, which will be soft delete column name, and then I write some code that's going to tell Entity Framework how to calculate the actual value to store in the annotation. So the two things I get as inputs are the CLR type and the list of attributes on that CLR type that are of type soft delete attribute. I'm only expecting one attribute to be there, so I'm just going to do a dot single, and then I just read the column name off the instance of that attribute. Now, a nice easy way to visualize this, I have the Entity Framework Power Tools installed. One of the things we use when we're debugging code first is the ability to write the in-memory object model that represents what EF thinks the model looks like out to an XML file. So I'm just going to kick that off. Again, with code first, we don't really care about XML files. This is just a nice way to visualize the model. So I mentioned there were three sections. There's the conceptual model that represents my CLR classes. There's the mapping. And then there's the storage model that represents the shape of the database. Ah, I missed a step. Let's go back. So I created a convention, but I never actually added it to the model builder. So we need to say model builder.conventions.add. Our custom convention, then we'll try that again. Okay, so we'll see here the listing entity in the storage model. This represents the shape of the listings table. And we'll see here we now have this custom annotation on there, the name of it being the soft delete column, and the value being the string that we put in the annotation. So now that we've got the annotation in the model, we need a way to read it back out and use it in the other parts of Entity Framework. So I've got a helper method here stubbed out on soft delete attribute. And it's going to look for an instance of the annotation on the type. So the type I'm going to be passing in will be the type from the Entity Framework model that represents the table. So I'm going to look for the annotation, which will be type.metadata properties. We need to filter this. We're going to filter it based on the property name. I'm going to use ends with, and I'll tell you why in a second. And then we expect either one or none to be there. Now, the reason I'm using ends with is because the name in the Entity Framework model is going to look like this horrible string I have here. And of course, this stuff is liable to change in future versions of Entity Framework. So I'm just going to take the last part of that name and find the annotation that ends with that. Now, the last thing I have to do is I made changes to my model to introduce the new isDeleted property, which has corresponding changes in the database too. So I need to add a migration to apply those changes to the database. We'll just call it soft. Now, what I would expect to be in this migration is a single operation to add the isDeleted column. But what we're going to see when it finishes scaffolding out the migration is it's actually included quite a bit more than that. And this is because we're using a model annotation. So with migrations, we scaffold out a bit of extra code. The reason we do this is it makes it easier. If that's an annotation that means you want to generate some different SQL in your migration SQL generator, then this stuff gets passed through and you can use it. Now, we're not going to do that because we don't actually want to use the annotations in migrations. We want to use the annotation in different places of the stack. So in this case, this code will actually achieve nothing. So I could just leave it there, but I like cleaner code, so we're just going to delete it. We'll do the same in the down. So now I have a much cleaner migration that I can go and apply to the database. Again, just to stress, I could have left the code there. It doesn't really do anything unless I add some logic to my SQL generator to process that annotation. Okay, so let's just flick back to our diagram quickly. We've implemented the top section now. We've got the column in the database, we've got the annotation in the model, and the ability to read the annotation back from the model. So now we want to look at the second slice there, which is when I write a query, I want to intercept it and tweak the object model of the query before it gets translated into SQL. So we'll swap back over to code, and I have stubbed out the beginnings of a soft delete interceptor. Now the interface I want to implement here is IDB command tree interceptor. So in the past you may have seen IDB command interceptor or DB command interceptor, which is the base class implementation of it. That allows me to intercept the query once it's already been translated to SQL. So we actually intercept the DB command. I don't want to do that here because then I would be forced to do string manipulation to apply the extra filter, which is pretty bad, right? So I'm going to intercept it a step earlier before it's translated into SQL. So we'll get the command tree interceptor. If I go ahead and implement that interface, we'll see it has a single method in it, which is basically a callback to us once the command tree has been created. Now, you might expect that this method would get called once for every query. You might be surprised to find out that this method actually gets called twice for every query. The reason for that is that we actually generate two command trees when you run a query. The first tree we generate is written in terms of your conceptual model. So the query is still an object model that represents the query in terms of your CLR classes, basically. We then run that through the mapping pipeline and translate it into a query in terms of your actual database. So to filter it, we're going to add an if statement. So interception context gives us a whole bunch of useful information about the tree that was created. Original result gives us the tree that EF calculated before it called our interceptor. And data space gets us the data space that it's targeting, whether that's conceptual or store. And we're only interested in things in the store space. Now, the reason I'm choosing store space instead of conceptual space is that everything's kind of normalized out, and it's a lot easier for me to manipulate the query once it's been translated. A good example of this, if I use an include method in my query, which means I'm going to pull in some related data. In the conceptual model query, that's still represented as an include. By the time I get to the store query, it's been flattened out to a join, so it's much easier to work with. So I'm going to use a code snippet to intercept the query tree. So I'm going to try and cast the incoming query to a DB query tree. So this means it's a query instead of an update, insert, or delete. If it is one of those things, I'm going to run some code, which we'll look at in a second, to calculate a new query. And then I'm going to construct a new command tree. So the command tree contains the query. It also contains the metadata about the objects I'm querying on, and it contains the data space that it's targeting. So most of that stuff, I just copy off the original query command, but I'm going to pass in the new query as well. Now, query command trees are a little bit complicated, and they're not mutable. So I can't just go and find one of the nodes and change it. I have to actually reconstruct the whole command tree when I want to tweak just a bit of it. Now, fortunately, I don't have to write that code. We have a visitor inside Entity Framework which helps me do this. So I'm going to inherit from default expression visitor. And what this does is give me a whole bunch of visit methods, which I can override. Well, let's zoom in when we can actually see it. Right, there we go. So a visit method for all the different types of expression that can be in my query. So this gives me a nice way I can just intercept one of them, replace it with a different node, return that from the visit method, and then EF will take care of reconstructing the query tree with my new node involved. So the one we want is DB scan expression. So I'm just going to scroll down and find that. So scan basically represents a select from a particular table. I'll show you what query trees look like in a second. Now, this code here, it might look simple, but it's actually very complicated to work out what to write when you want to manipulate query trees. So I'll just walk through the code quickly. We try and find a column using the helper method that we wrote before to see if this entity type that we're scanning from has the soft delete column annotation. If it does, we create a reference to the table. It's kind of like a variable that points to the table. And then we create a filter on that. And so we want to filter to see if the property called column is not equal to true. Obviously, I could have also done equal to false, but not equal true made more sense to me. If the thing doesn't have the column annotation on it, then we just want to call the base visit method. Okay, so let's pause here for a second. How would I work out what code to write here? So if you call toString on one of these query trees or command trees, it actually gives you a visualization of what the query looks like. So I'm going to open them up for you. So this is actually how I worked out what code to write. This is a dump of the command tree before I started messing with it. And so it gives me an idea of what types of nodes are in here. So I can see there's a table scan on the listing entity. So then I've come through here and I've just replaced that with a filter that points to a scan on the listing entity. And then all the ways that I construct expressions, you can't actually instantiate new instances of the expression. You have to use this DB Expression Builder class, which is basically a giant factory class which has hundreds of methods on it for creating different types of expressions. Okay, so now that we have our visitor implemented, we're going to go back to our class and use it. So on the query command, we want to get the actual query, and then we're going to call accept a new instance of our soft delete visitor. If you're not familiar with the visitor pattern, then you could just Bing or your other search engine of choice, visitor pattern, will kind of explain what's going on there. Okay, so now that we have our soft delete interceptor completed for queries, we need to actually register it with Entity Framework. So I have a code-based configuration class here. So all I had to do was derive from DB configuration and put it in the same assembly as my DB context, and Entity Framework will automatically find this configuration and load it for me when the application runs. So I'm going to call the addInterceptor method with a new instance of our softDelete interceptor. And then before we run our application, let's go and start a trace. So I'm using SQL Server Profiler to trace what's going on. And we'll run the application. So I'll just hit the listings controller, then we'll go to profiler. So when I hit the listings controller, it actually executes two queries. I didn't want EF to use include to pull all the data back with joins. In my case, it was quicker for me to execute two separate queries. So the first query loads all the listings, the second query loads all the listing photos. So you can see the query here for listing photos. And because we didn't put the soft delete attribute on it, there's no additional filters applied here. We're just selecting straight from the listing photos table. If I go up to the query above it, you'll see that this is a select from dbo.listings, but this time I have a filter on it to say where is deleted is not equal to one. It's because it's stored as a bit column, so I guess I can't zoom in, but not equal to one is equivalent of not equal to true. Now, we also hit the home controller, and the home controller is a little bit more complicated because it does pull in some data using the include method, and it also does some filtering and sorting and things like that. So if we look at the query for that, it's way more complicated. But the two things I want to call out here, we'll see we're selecting from listings with the filter applied, but we're also joining to listing photos, but there's no filter applied to that. So because we're only intercepting DB scan expressions where the annotation is applied, that means we can combine both soft delete and non-soft delete entities in the same query. All right, so there's one last piece to implement if we flick back to our slide, and that's the bottom row there, which is when somebody deletes an entity, we actually want to replace that with an update command instead of a delete command. So fortunately, we already have a command tree interceptor defined, so we're just going to go and reuse that one. And I'm going to use some code to intercept delete trees. So I try and cast it to a DB delete command tree. If it is a delete command, I'll see if it has the soft delete column name annotation on it. And if it does, I'm going to replace the delete with an update. So again, I'm just using the DB expression builder class to build a set clause. So a set being the equivalent of set is deleted equal to true. That's what I'm building there. And then I go ahead and create a new DB update command tree. So this is something you couldn't do until 6.1.1. Most of the stuff I copy from the original delete command. So we're using the same metadata, we're targeting the same data space, we're targeting the same table. The predicate is the equivalent of the where clause, so it probably would have said delete where ID equals 4. So we want to leave that where clause on our update command. And then we pass in the new set clause. So let's run the application. We'll go to the listings, we'll pick one of these to delete. Let's delete this one here. Yes, please. So as far as our application is concerned, the data has been deleted. If we go and look in the database, we'll see that instead of being deleted, it's actually just set the isDeleted column. Something wrong with my zoom. The isDeleted column has been set to true. Now, if that delete was a mistake, I could now come in here and change the isDeleted column back to false, come back to my UI, refresh, and my data is undeleted from the database. Okay, so the point of this demo, I mean, it would be great if EF included soft deletes in the framework, but I was just showing that with some of the pieces we've been introducing and the extension points, it's possible to work around the limitations of Entity Framework and introduce your own behavior. Okay, so the next demo we're going to look at is a kind of a similar case. EF doesn't have native support for full text search built in. So we're going to look at using a few different pieces in Entity Framework to implement full text search. So we're going to use raw SQL queries. They've been around since EF4, a custom migration operation, which was new in EF6, and the public mapping API. That's the ability to find out what table a type maps to and what column a property maps to from Entity Framework. So let's swap back to Visual Studio. Well, actually, we'll start with the application. So you see I have a search box here, and I'm going to search for Dream. And you'll see here that it finds this particular listing because it has that it's a renovator's dream. But if I go and look at the listings, I'll see there's also the American dream. And I'm guessing for most people, the American dream and the renovator's dream aren't the same thing. So it would actually be better if our search could return both of these. So let's go look at the search controller. Or rather, the search action on the listings controller. So it's here, and we can see at the moment it's just doing a where on the description. So what I could do is say where description contains the search term or where the title contains a search term. The problem with this is that contains is translated into like into SQL Server, and that's not a very performant way to do this query. So to start with, we're just going to introduce some SQL to do full text search. And then I can run a SQL query here using the SQL and passing in the search term. Now, one thing I want to point out here, we have to be careful when we drop to raw SQL because the search term is untrusted text coming from the user. So it's a prime candidate for a SQL injection attack. A user could start punching some SQL into there. So with Entity Framework, I have this nice syntax where I can say at P0, which is the equivalent of string.format with the squigglies with a zero in the middle. It says, here's a placeholder for a parameter. And then I can pass those parameters in after I've specified the SQL to search for. EF will take care of wrapping that search term up into a SQL parameter for me and passing along with a query so we get safe parameterized SQL in the database. Now, I could run this. It's not going to work at the moment, though, because I haven't enabled full text indexes in the database. So to do that, I could swap to SQL Management Studio and add a full text index. But that doesn't work very well because I'm using migrations to maintain my database. So let's go and add a migration. Now what's interesting here is I don't have any changes to my model, but I can still add a migration, and EF will just scaffold a blank migration for me. And I could add stuff in here. I could add extra columns that aren't in my model. I could add indexes that aren't in my model, anything I wanted to. But there's no first class API in EF to say create full text index. So what I could do if I wanted to is just write some SQL, but I've already had to use SQL and I really don't like dropping down to SQL. So what we're going to look at is introducing a first class API that is our own custom one here to handle creating full text indexes. So the first thing we need to do is create a migration operation. So I've got a class stubbed out here and we're going to inherit migration operation. If I implement the base class, the only thing that it requires of me is a flag to say whether this is a destructive change. This is what EF uses to prompt you, like, are you sure you want to run this? It's going to cause data loss. We're creating stuff, so that's never going to be destructive, one would hope. And we're going to add some stuff we need to know about for full text indexes. So we'll add that. Oh, by the way, that's not a snippet that ships with Visual Studio. I made that one up. So the stuff we need to know about is the table we want to create the full text index on. Full text indexes have to reference back to a real unique index on the table, so we need to specify that. And then we need to specify the columns that we want to be indexed. So I've got all that information in this class. Now, what I don't want to do inside my migration is new up an instance of this create full text index operation, because I like using nice APIs like create index, etc. So we're going to add an extension method that will take care of creating one of these for us. So we'll go to DB context extensions, DB migration extensions. I've stubbed out a method here called create full text index. And using a code snippet, we'll add some code that takes the inputs and creates a full text index operation for us. And then it goes and adds it to the migration. Now you'll notice I'm casting to IDB migration here. IDB migration is kind of an obfuscating interface. It's explicitly implemented on the class, so when you're inside DB migration and you're typing your actual migration code, you don't see the members on this interface. That's because we want to hide the fact that you can add operations. We just want you to see the nice, polished extension methods or instance methods that help you easily create things. So now if we go back to our migration, we can say this.create full text index, there's our extension method. Because it's an extension method, I did unfortunately have to put this dot at the start. So the table we want to target is dbo.listings. The index, I'm just going to target the primary key index, which in my case happens to be called pk_dbo.listings. I worked that out by going to SQL Management Studio and seeing what the index was called. That also happens to be the default of what Code First will generate. And then we're going to specify the columns that we want the index on. Okay, so now we've done that, let's just try and update the database. We'll get an exception. And we're getting an exception because we've created this new operation, but the SQL generator has no idea what to do with it. And so what this text is telling us is that the SQL Server Migration SQL Generator, there's a mouthful, doesn't know how to handle this operation, and I should consider deriving from it and then registering my own migration SQL generator. So again, I've stubbed out the start of my own migration SQL generator. I don't want to implement one from scratch, so what I'm going to do is just derive from our default one that ships in the box. And so I see one of the things I can override is a whole bunch of generate methods. So if I wanted to tweak the SQL that was generated for one of these well-known types of operations, I could just override this method and change the SQL that gets generated. But that's not what we want to do. We want to deal with a type of operation that this migration SQL generator doesn't know about. So I'm going to kind of override the entry point method. And we're going to intercept the create full text index operation. So I'm going to try and cast the operation to a create full text index operation. If it is one of those things, I'm going to write some custom code in a second to generate the SQL. And if it's not one of those things, I'm just going to let the base generator handle the SQL generation. So we'll generate some SQL to create a full text index. So I'm doing a bit of magic here. This part here is handling the generation of the SQL for the full text index. A full text index in SQL requires a full text catalog for it to reside in. And if I don't specify one, it tries to use the default for the database. So I've got a bit of extra SQL at the top here saying, if there isn't a default full text catalog, then just go ahead and create the default one for me. Of course, I could have a separate migration operation to do this, but in my case, I just want it to be transparent. Now you'll notice I'm using writer here. This gives us an indented text writer, and the base class will take care of popping the indents to the right level before it gets to this method. So this just means if I wrote out a script for the migration operation, it's going to be neatly indented with the rest of the script. So that's why I'm not just constructing the string myself using a string builder or something. Okay, now to actually get EF to use this SQL generator, I need to go to the migrations configuration and say set SQL generator. Now the first thing I need to give it is the name of the provider that I want this SQL generator to work for. Because migrations could be targeting Oracle and SQL, and the migrations themselves are kind of provider independent. So I want to set this one for SQL Server. So I could go ahead and type system.data.sqlclient, but I hate magic strings. So in EF6, we introduced some static helper properties for you. So we can go from SQL Provider Services.provider invariant name, and then a new instance of my custom migration SQL generator. Let's run update database again. Okay, it worked, that's good. We can see it in the database. If we go and look at the full text indexes on the listings table, oops, that's not the one I meant to click. That is. So we can see there is our full text for listings introduced, and we can see that it's on the title and description columns. And if we swap back to Visual Studio and run our application, I'm going to search for Dream again, and then hopefully this time we get two different listings. So we're now using full text indexes on our table to search both the title and the description. Now, obviously, my use of full text index is pretty restricted. You can now use all the nice benefits of full text index, like thesauruses and all the other complicated operations you could use with full text search. Okay, so the one thing that's a little bit fragile here with my SQL generation is that EF has a concept of mapping. But if I look at my SQL here, it's hard-coded to dbo.listings. And that's a problem. If I ever change the name of the table that the listing class maps to, this SQL is going to break. So I'm going to call an extension method. And to be clear, this isn't part of the framework. This is something I've written in code here. We're going to look at it in a second. OK, so we've got the name of the table. And then I'm going to use string.format, and we'll talk about my use of string.format here in a second. And we're going to pass in the table. And we want to replace the listings here with the table that we found. Now, the reason I couldn't do string.format or concatenation or something with the term variable is that that's untrusted. I don't know what it is. In this case, the table is coming from my model where I said what the table I'm mapping to is. So in this case, I'm comfortable with doing string concatenation because I know I'm not going to go and name my table delete star from sys whatever objects. Okay, so this method, unfortunately, at the moment does nothing. So let's fix that. Now, Entity Framework is an object relational mapper. So our kind of bread and butter is working out what table an entity maps to. So you would expect this code to be extremely clean and easy and intuitive. So what I would like everyone to do is close their eyes and imagine a neat little line of code while I expand this code. Okay, forget it. It's horrible. So we're actually going to use this as an example when we get to EF7. But there's a reason the mapping API wasn't public. We kept saying, we're going to fix it, we're going to fix it, we're going to fix it. And we kind of fixed it in EF6.1 and said, we're just going to make this thing public. We know it's horrible. We don't have the time to fix it, but people want to use it. Now, I've written this code many times, and I still have to go to my own blog and find my own post that says how to use this API every time I want to use it. So feel free to do the same thing. And rest assured, we are fixing this in EF7. All right, so that beautiful code now works, and our application is up and running, dynamically pulling the name of the table to access from the metadata that EF has. Now, obviously, the column names, we'd probably want to do a similar thing for the column names, too. Just to prove that it actually still works, we'll do a quick search, and it does. Okay, next demo, testing without hitting a database. Now, if folks have seen me do this demo before, rest assured, this one's a little bit different. We made it a little bit easier. So at the heart of this demo, we're using the ability to mock a DB set, which was introduced in EF6. So in EF6, we made it possible to publicly construct a DB set. It's not going to work, it's not going to access the database, but it means you can use something like a mocking framework to create test doubles of it, or you can write your own test doubles that inherit from DB set. So we'll go back to Visual Studio. Remember that the home page of our intranet application would display the two most recent listings. So we're going to write a unit test to make sure it continues to behave that way. So here we have the home controller test. And we have a bunch of test data here that we're going to test against. It's just some listings in a list. A bunch of IDs not sorted in any particular order. So we would expect it to pull out ID 4 and 3. So to be clear, the way it works out the two most recent listings, I have a store-generated key that gets bigger over time, so I would expect the two highest numbers to be the two most recent listings. Now, one of the things I have installed here, if I look at my NuGet packages, is I have these two packages here, entityframework.testing, which includes some helpful methods. So if you want to mock a DB set and be able to use the asynchronous query methods, then you need to write a whole bunch of code. So to be clear, this isn't a Microsoft-supported package. This is just a little pet project of mine. But I provided an implementation of that code in a NuGet package, so you don't have to write it yourself. The testing.mock package goes a little bit further, and it includes some helper methods for setting up mocks of DB sets. So let's look at using that now. So we need to create a mock of our set. So we use mock DB set. This is a type from that NuGet package. But if I go to it, you'll see that it just inherits from a mock of DB set of T. So I have all the standard mock methods for setting up things there. But I also have some other extension methods. So in addition to all the setup methods I get with mock, I also have this setup seed data. So I can say, use this data. And I can also set up link to work with this fake DB set. So now I want to create a context. So I'm just mocking the context directly and wiring up the listings property to return my mock DB set. So we're now going to run the test. We're going to create an instance of our home controller, passing in our mocked context. And then we're going to call the index action on that controller. The index action is asynchronous, so we need to use the await keyword there. The final thing to do, of course, a test is useless if it doesn't check if stuff worked. So we're going to assert that two results come back and that they're ordered descending by the two most recent results. So we would expect the IDs 4 and 3 to be there. If I go to my test explorer and we're going to run this test, we'll see, hopefully, that it passes, which it does, which is good. So we were able to test this behavior of the controller without hitting a database. All right, so the final thing I want to show you on EF6 is the ability to enable logging without recompiling. Now, this is important. If I have a deployed application, I don't want to have to edit the code in my application, rebuild it, and redeploy it just to be able to trace an issue going on in my application. So let's swap back to Visual Studio. I'm going to do this outside of Visual Studio, just so you believe me that I'm not recompiling the application. So here is the folder that I've been working in. I'm going to open up the web.config file. And if I scroll down to the Entity Framework section, and I'm just going to pull in some settings that I wrote earlier. So I'm introducing the new interceptors section in the config file. I'm registering a new interceptor, which is of type database logger. This is an interceptor that will just write the stream of what's happening with SQL out to a text file. It's in the Entity Framework assembly. It has two constructor parameters. One is the text file that I want to write to. So I'm going to write to c:tempef.log. And the second one is whether I want to append or overwrite the file as each request comes in. So I want to append. So I'm saying append equals true. So I'm going to save that. We're going to open up c:temp. Put that on one side. We'll open up our website on the others. We'll go and hit listings. We'll see EFLog just appeared. Here come the listings, and if we go and look at it, I can see all the SQL that EF is generating. So I was able to do all of that without having to actually compile and redeploy my application. All right, my favorite part. We're going to skip that one because we don't have time. Let's talk about EF7 and where we're going. So in Entity Framework 6, we support full .NET. So that means ASP.NET, WPF, WinForms, console applications, things like that. And we support relational databases. In EF7, we want to push Entity Framework a bit and start targeting some new scenarios. So we want to make EF available on new platforms. So this is going to include Windows Phone and Windows Store applications, or the new universal applications that target both. This is also going to include, if you're in Scott Hunter and Scott Hanselman's talk yesterday, .NET vNext, including the cloud-optimized version of .NET. We also want to target new data stores. So non-relational is very popular these days. Don't freak out when you see this. What we're not going to do is build some magic thing that hides the fact that you're targeting a relational or a non-relational data store. We're going to dig into this in a second, but we're going to take some of the patterns that apply to relational data stores, but we think also apply to non-relational data stores as well. So as we looked at wanting to head in this direction, we had to take a very realistic look at the code base we have for EF6 at the moment. It's been around for a long time. It was built 15 years ago or more. Software design's come a long way in 15 years, thankfully. We have heavy use of APIs that aren't available on all of these new platforms, like dynamic assembly generation and things like that can't be done on all these platforms. EF makes heavy use of that stuff. Over 15 years, not surprisingly, we've accumulated a lot of baggage. There's a lot of features and a lot of code that is strewn throughout the EF code base that just isn't even used. In fact, a lot of it you can't even use from the DBContext API these days. But the code is still there, and it would be very difficult to remove. It's difficult to remove because EF is kind of an old school code base, and everything's kind of mushed together. It's like a big plate of spaghetti, and if you want to change one of the little noodles, you end up moving all the other noodles out the way, and you break everything. So it's very fragile. We also have unintuitive behaviors. The best example of this, if you take an entity and add it to the context, you expect EF to register that entity as added, which it does. But it also scans all the other entities referenced from that entity and marks them as added as well, which is not very intuitive. So if I add a blog, well, guess what? All my posts are also marked as added, and all the tags that those posts refer to are marked as added as well. And because of the monolithic implementation, this stuff is just impossible for us to change. It would take a very long time, and we would break everything trying to do it. EF was also built in a different era where it's not optimized for low memory usage. And this is important as we look at running applications on small devices like phones and tablets, or as we look to cloud computing where we want to try and cram as many applications we can onto a single instance of a server to cut down on cost. EF has reasonably high memory usage at the moment. And of course, EF, right throughout the stack, has very tight coupling to relational concerns. Now, in some places of the stack, this makes sense, because parts of the stack are very specific to relational databases. But there are also very large parts of the stack that would be useful when targeting other data stores, but we can't do that because relational is baked in from the top down. Now everyone's going to freak out and say, now Microsoft's announcing a new data access stack. Don't worry, I'm not going to do that. What we are going to do is in the next version of EF, we're going to look at building a lighter weight, more extensible version. So don't freak out, it's still Entity Framework. We're just pulling forward the commonly used features. But also, because we're building a lot of this stuff from scratch, we get to bake in some features that were very, very difficult to build into the old code base, but we can build them into this new one right from the start. And of course, it will be built using modern design patterns, because we're 15 years down the track now, we know how to build software better. Now, this one's probably a little bit more controversial. The first part's probably not. Most folks are using the DB Context API at the moment. What we're seeing, CodeFirst hasn't been around for that long. It's been around for a lot less time than the EF Designer, but we've actually got some telemetry now that's telling us that people, the majority of users, even though CodeFirst has been around for nowhere near as long, the majority of people are actually using CodeFirst instead of the EF Designer. Now, this does not mean that we won't have some tooling over the top of CodeFirst that gives you a visual designer. It doesn't mean that we will either, but I'm just saying don't read CodeFirst only as in there will be no UI, everything will be code. There's not going to be any XML files, no EDMX files for sure. Now, when we talk about lightweight and extensible, I want to be clear, we're not talking about building an object micro ORM. So this would be things like Dapper. This is still EF. It's still going to have link. It's still going to do change tracking. It's still going to have the unit of work pattern and all those things we expect from ORM. Don't get me wrong. I'm definitely not bagging on micro ORMs. They're a good tool to have in your tool belt. There's definitely places to use them. That's just not, EF's not a micro ORM, and we're not going to try and change it into a micro ORM. And I said we're going to support non-relational as well. Like I said, we're not going to try and do something magic that hides what kind of data store you're talking to. The parts of EF that make sense to use for all data stores, you will be able to do that. The parts of it that are tied very strongly to relational are going to remain that way. So for example, if I say I'm targeting SQL Server or any relational database, then I want to be able to configure things like cascade delete on my foreign key columns. That only makes sense in SQL Server. So those will be pulled in as extensions when I say I'm targeting SQL Server. If I'm targeting Azure Table Storage, for example, I'm not going to have the ability to set up cascade deletes because that doesn't make any sense. So let's chew through some design principles and then we should get into some demos, hey? So we want to keep it looking like EF6 where it makes sense. So by default, the API will look the same as EF6, but we are going to break it in some places where we think it makes sense. Pay-per-play means if I don't use part of EF, I don't pay the cost for A, having to know about it, B, load the assemblies into memory and deal with the CPU overhead. This is especially important when we look at the cloud. I mean, we automatically think device, right? Constrained resources. What about the cloud where I pay for CPU cycles? So this actually can have an impact on the amount of money you pay to host your applications. Extensible. So we're still going to have a nice DB context API that kind of wires everything up for you. But that's going to be a facade over some low-level building blocks, and you will be able to replace those with your own implementations or derive from ours and extend them. You've seen bits of this in the DB context API where it's fairly easy to replace things. And we even looked at some of that in the demos of EF6. But unfortunately, DB context API is kind of the tip of the iceberg that sits over the top of this behemoth monolithic code base that we have where you can't go and replace things. Sensible defaults. A good example of this is, I think, CodeFirst conventions. I think we do a pretty good job of discovering the model for you. The good thing about it is if you don't like the way we discover your model, it is very easy to start taking over building the model and specifying what it looks like. Less magic. Where I think we do some bad magic would be database discovery. So I write my code first application, I create my context, I press F5, and it does a whole bunch of magic behind the scenes to create a database for me. I didn't tell it where to create a database. It makes the database look like it was created using migrations, so that later if I enable migrations, it can jimmy a whole bunch of code into my solution to make it look like that code generated the database. This stuff is too much magic. Like, it confuses people, it creates bugs, people don't know where their databases are. So in EF7, we want to tone the magic back a bit to where you can have a sensible default, but it's very obvious what EF is doing, and you can easily grow up into taking over those concerns as you want to. If you have applications using EF6, or you have a lot of knowledge with EF6, you don't have to upgrade. EF6 is still supported. Now, we always support old versions. Like, you can use EF5 today, and that's supported. But we know that this move from 6 to 7 is going to be a little bit bigger, and so you can expect us to, I guess, take more seriously the support on EF6. And upgrades to the EF6 are going to continue. In fact, we've been working on EF7 for a while now, and we've delivered EF6.1 and the 6.1.1 patch in tandem with working on EF7. We're going to keep doing that going forwards, at least for a while. Not everybody's going to be able to move straight away, because you might be using features that aren't going to be in EF7 in the initial release. There's going to be some stuff that's not there from the start. And for us, we know that when frameworks break you, it's painful. So we're only going to break where it makes sense, and we're going to try and make the transition from 6 to 7 as easy as possible. So, like we said, same concepts, same patterns. It's still going to be EF. It'll still be DB context. If you're just using the DB context API, and it's fairly simple, the code changes will be very minimal. If you're using some of the more advanced features, then there may be some more involved code changes needed there. And so, two ways you can get involved. We're open source as of yesterday. You can find us. There's a link in the Bitly bundle that I've got on the screen there. We also have nightly builds available. I want to be clear, the code base is very early days yet. You're going to see that when I demo. So we haven't done an official alpha or anything yet, but you can get the nightly builds and try it out. The open source code base, which is hosted on GitHub, by the way, has a whole bunch of samples and, well, not a whole bunch. It has some samples and some content to get you started. Okay, so that all sounds great on slides, right? But what does that really mean when we dig into things? So let's look at some new data stores. Swap back to Visual Studio. So I'm going to load up a different application now. We're still working with Fake Estate, but this is their public website. So this is where users can come. They can log in. Let's just log in. They can browse the listings that Fake Estate has online at the moment. So this data is all coming from the same relational database we were using before. And I have the ability to take notes. So I could test this out. Hit save. But at the moment, you'll see if I refresh, the notes aren't actually getting persisted anywhere. So let's swap to Visual Studio and look, try and fix that problem. Now, this application is using Entity Framework 7. I have it installed. So let's take a quick look at the listings context that I have here. You'll see I'm just pulling a connection string from web.config. So it derives from DB context, same as in EF6. It has DB sets, the same as in EF6. Has non-model creating, the same as in EF6. We have this new method on configuring. So this is part of doing less magic. So you need to tell us some things about what you want to target. So I'm saying I want to use SQL Server using this connection string that I pulled from web.config. By the way, we will have some better syntax here for, you know, automatically pulling the connection string from a config if you tell us to. It's early bits. At the moment, I have to use Configuration Manager. Now, I get this use SQL Server because I have the SQL Server provider installed in my application. If I didn't have SQL Server installed and I had some other database provider, then I would have the extension methods from that one. So let's go and look at notes. So here's a notes context. We're going to derive from DB context. And I'm going to override the onConfiguring method. Now, I could store this stuff in a relational database, but when it comes to notes, there's really only one thing I want to do. Given the current user that's logged in and the current listing they're looking at, find that note. I don't want to do any filtering. I don't want to do any kind of advanced queries or anything. I just want to get the note from the database. So this would actually be a prime candidate for Azure Table Storage, say. So let's say use Azure Table Storage, because I have that provider installed. And we'll pass in the connection string. Now that connection string, if we just swap to the Storage Explorer, points to this table storage that I've got here, which currently has no tables in it at all. So empty Azure Table Storage. So now that we have the context set up, we can start using it. So let's go over to the controller. And I'm going to create a new instance of it. About notes context. Okay, so I have one controller that has two contexts, one targeting a relational database and one targeting Azure Table Storage. We're going to scroll down to here. So the views for this controller are bound to this view model. And the view model really has two things. It has the listing and it has the note on it. The listing is getting populated using the listings context or the fake estate context. And we want to be able to set the result. That's not what I want. Okay, so I'm running a link query here. So, oh, we called up the wrong thing. Let's go back to the notes context. We forgot to expose a DB set, so let's add that. Okay, so now we're happy. Interestingly, so there's two ways to write link queries, right? I can use this kind of method chaining syntax where I write lambdas in there. I can also do this one. Achieves exactly the same thing, but it looks a little more like SQL. I'm always interested in this. How many folks in the room with a show of hands prefer this second option that I put up on the screen? And how many folks prefer the first option? Awesome, 50-50. That makes it really clear. Let's stick with this one, seeing as I have it typed out. Okay, so the second action we're going to work on is the one that updates notes. So it gets the listing ID in the note, and we need to save it to the storage. So the first thing I'm going to do is look in the database and see if there's already an existing note for this user and this listing. So we go to the notes DB, we use the same query and pull it back. If there isn't one in the database, it will just be null. So if it is null, we need to create a new note. And in that case, we want to register it as added with the notes DB. And then finally, regardless of whether it was added or it's an existing note, I want to go and set the actual text of the notes, and I want to set the last modified time on there. And then finally, to make sure we actually persist all this stuff, we want to go and save changes. So remember, my Azure Table Storage doesn't have any tables in it yet. So let's go to startup.cs. It's probably the wrong place to write this, but we'll put it there anyway. db.database.create. Database is a little misleading. That kind of seems relational. Maybe a better name would be db.datastore.create. All right, let's run our app and see what happens. So it's going to take a little longer to load this time because it's actually doing something on startup. So we go to table storage. And we refresh. We'll see the new note table created in Azure Table Storage for us. And then let's go to our actual application. We'll go to one of the listings. Looks great. Save it. Go back to Azure Table Storage. Run a query. And we'll see the note is created in Azure Table Storage for us. We're using the user's ID from identity as a partition key, the listing ID as a row key, and then we have the user's data stored there for us. We can also go back to the application. Maybe this guy's Australian like I am. Looks great, mate. Save it. Come back, run the query again. And we see the data updated in Azure Table Storage. Okay, so the point here is we were able to use Entity Framework with familiar coding patterns to target a data store that wasn't a relational database. Okay, and so then for my last demo, I mentioned new platforms. So let's take a look at what that looks like. So we're going to dig into one more application. This is still a public application, but in this time, instead of being a website, this is actually a universal application that targets Windows Phone and Windows Store. So we're going to start with the phone application, which is here. So I can punch in something I want to look for, Dream, hit enter. It talks through a remote service, so it's pulling back for remote data from the SQL database using a remote service, and it pulls it back and displays it on the screen. Now what I want to do is be able to capture the user's search history and be able to prompt them with suggestions based on stuff they've searched for in the past. Now I could wire that up to talk to a remote service, That doesn't really make sense because a user's search history is very specific to them. And it's also not particularly critical. If they wipe their device, it doesn't really matter that much if they lose their search history. So let's look at using some kind of local storage to save that data. If I look at the phone application, you can see there's a bit of code here. Every time the page is loaded or the app is loaded, we go through this search history helper to get a list of previous search terms. And every time they run a search, we record the search term via the search history helper. And then we query for the actual data for the search based on the remote fake estate service. So let's dig into this search history helper. Now, because this is a universal application, that search history helper lives in the shared project of my application. So it's shared between the phone and the store. So if we go and look at the helper, it doesn't do anything at the moment. It always returns an empty list of previous searches, and it doesn't do anything when we record the search term. We do have some code stubbed out here to use Entity Framework, but it's not going to work yet. So let's go to the search history context. We'll inherit from DB context. You all know this. We need a DB set of search term. Search term just being my POCO class. Okay, so now we need to choose what data store to connect to. So we're going to say find a connection string. This is just some conditional code because where I store temporary data or user data differs depending on whether I'm using the phone or a store application. On a device, my default database of choice would probably be SQLite connection. Okay, so now we can go to the search history helper. Let's just uncomment this code. And then the final thing I need to do, this database doesn't actually exist at the moment, so similar to what we did in the last application, we're going to go to the startup of our application. We'll just stick it in here. We want to create an instance of the search history context. All right, let's run it. Hopefully I didn't miss anything. All right, so our emulator is just going to have the app redeployed to it. It'll load up. We'll go ahead and search for Dream. Finds the stuff. Oh, you can see it's already starting to work. Let's search for Gardens too. Gonna find some different stuff. So we're seeing the data there being stored for us and retrieved from a SQLite database on the phone. Now, just so you believe me that it's actually working, we'll just stop it in VS and redeploy it. And when it opens up again, even though the app has been redeployed, we see the data that we typed in before coming back from the SQLite database stored in the user's profile on the phone. Now, because this is a universal application, I also have a Windows Store version of this app. So let's go look at that. So Windows Store kind of has the concept of a search box built in. So I've got a, where is it, search box here. The search box in Windows Store actually also supports some version of search history as well, but I've got that disabled because this is a common functionality between the two platforms that I've written. I want to use the same consistent search history on both of my applications. If we look at the code behind, you'll just see we're delegating again to the search history helper. So when the search box asks for a list of search suggestions, we delegate to the search history helper. And when a query is submitted via the search box, we go and record the term, again, using the search history helper. So let's set this as a startup project. Now, I happen to have a link to the local state of this application. So this is the local state folder for this application on my hard drive. Let's go back to here. Get things over that side. Let's run it. Just build and then deploy it to Windows for me. And then it's going to launch. We can execute some queries, get the same results back. Gardens, again, we see it starting to load and query data. And if I go to my local state for this application, I can see the SQLite database created on disk for me. Okay, so that's going to wrap us up for today. I'm sure folks have lots of questions. So after this, I'm going to be at the Developer Tools booth from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. There's also another session on EF later today, so be sure to check that one out as well. And as always, we like you to complete evaluations. Just seriously, on evaluations, they actually do help us. We really do pay attention to them, so please do go and fill one out for this session and the other sessions you attend. With that, I'm going to thank you very much for your time. I'll stick around for a few minutes for questions. Thank you.